Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roerink, Simon Schuster, Jacob Kanzler, Abby Walls, and Jack Spencer. Thank God Jack's here. A little Corey Hart intro music here. I lost my sunglasses over the weekend, so I'm wearing my sunglasses inside.
No, you mean you lost your glasses this weekend, so you're wearing your sunglasses inside. You said you lost your sunglasses.
And I wore them last night, too, in the dark. So I wore my sunglasses at night, okay. And I did, until they hurt my eyes because I couldn't see. So I took them off, and I couldn't see there either. So
you're just having trouble.
Then I just went to sleep.
Yeah.
But now that's not an option because we are here.
Do you get sleepy during the day when you're wearing your sunglasses, Kyle?
No, not if it's bright enough. I did not lose my glasses during the Mackinac Policy Conference because I was not there, but John Roerink was there. And John, after everything's all said and done, does the media overcover the Mackinac Policy Conference?
I think the media has always kind of overcovered the Mackinac Conference. But I think part of that is just because you have such a concentration of leaders. And sometimes those leaders don't really come out with any news. They just happen to be there. So when you have that many reporters, you're going to get a little bit of an overcoverage.
That's kind of the whole point of it, too, Abby. This is your first time covering it. But the whole point is it's like shooting fish in a barrel, right? I mean, you go so you can see the people and talk to them. I think that's why the radio folks are there. That's why all the morning radio shows are there. But it's not necessarily because you're going to get news, right? I mean, the lead story out of the Mackinac Policy Conference was
DPS.
but the funny thing is, though, is that the story was not up at Mackinac on DPS. It was actually back in Lansing. And in that regards, did the House Republicans upstage the Detroit Regional Chamber Policy Conference?
In some ways, yes. I mean, the first 2 days of the conference were entirely talking about education, DPS. Mayor Duggan really riled up with his keynote on DPS. I feel like the story of the week was House Republicans aren't here, and they're working on Detroit's education.
I think the story may yet be written on what the news was up there, actually, because what I'm curious about is how much of this did they actually agree to before the conference began? How much did the governor know and the majority leader know and just remain silent through this conference while the House passed this bill that they knew that they were going to roll over and just initial?
And roll over not on Tuesday, not
no,
on Wednesday,
Thursday.
But on Thursday,
right.
After it was logistically impossible for any member to get up to the island.
Right. And the other interesting part of that, I thought, of the island was the newsworthiness. If you look at the language and listen to the governor's address on Friday, he did a very adroit job of kind of letting everyone know what was going to happen and let them down gently, and they gave him a round of applause and a standing ovation at the end. So it was kind of interesting from that aspect where he basically told them, you're not going to get this DEC. I support the DEC, but you're not going to get it. There's all these other great things, and then they gave him a standing ovation. He walks out, and there's the story.
And then you had Arlen Meekhoff say, essentially, we're very close. We're very, very, very close.
Yes, we're close. Every day we make progress.
So what's the very? The very was basically, we're just waiting for the House Republicans to vote.
Don't you wonder
yeah.
if that wasn't the deal?
Exactly, as if that doesn't happen before. And so now, Jack, the charter schools did pretty well on this. Why does it seem like the charters are always getting what they want right now?
Well, the House seems to be pretty much in agreement with the school of choice movement. And this year, in case anyone's noticed, you do have the House weighing in on issues, beginning with the road funding, where they are not just rolling over to the Senate, which, as we know, over the years, the Senate has tended to pretty much win these battles or win 90% of what they want in these battles. This time around, the House has been asserting itself this year on that, on the road funding, and they dug in their heels. They're the ones on the ballot, and there's been a lot of pressure put on them to go to bat for the charters and the DPS situation. And,
well, that was going to be my point. Is the reason there's so much deference being given the House is because they're actually the ones on the ballot. They're the ones whose skin is on the line.
Well, that's interesting, too, because you would think it'd be the other way around. You'd think they were the ones that wanted to get out of town. You'd think they would be the ones that would have the greater tendency to give in because they're concerned about getting out there. Instead, they're the ones who have drawn the line and said, we're not going any farther than this. And it looks like, we don't know what's going to happen this week, but it looks like they may end up getting their version of it.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of Kevin Cotter speaking with reporters afterwards, basically midnight Friday morning. Tell me, have you spoke with Senate Majority Leader Mikoff today about these bills that you just passed?
I have.
What did he tell you?
Let me say that I wouldn't have put them up for a vote if I didn't have confidence that it would not have been votes in vain.
Do you think this is the last vote we're going to see in this chamber on DPS?
I do.
This is it?
This is it.
Speaker, what role do you see this advisory council that is in this bill instead of the DEC? What do you think that's going to accomplish?
You know, this will be a group, three from the public schools, three from charter schools, one of each being a parent, the student in the respective schools, an opportunity to give input. An opportunity to give input as to school location and an opportunity to give input as to a transportation plan, but nothing that would have a binding effect, but rather will be made public in the way of recommendations.
Adam Demke suggested that this was the House GOP doing the bidding of the DeVos family. Any response?
It's insulting, not shocking, because they've said it before, but there's no merit to it whatsoever. You know, this is putting forward a responsible plan with reforms that protect taxpayers across the state. I don't do anyone's bidding, but rather lead a caucus, and this is a plan that I fully support.
Can you talk about how it's going to specifically help Detroit schools, parents, and students?
Absolutely. First, by keeping the doors open. You know, as I was mentioning during the floor speech, this is now $665 million that is being delivered in the way of dollars. This is about the reforms that are included in the package to try to see the educational attainment standards lifted. The results that we're getting are absolutely deplorable, and that is what should be so offensive to parents across the city of Detroit. And I think it's proven that they are disgusted by the results, because now 53% of the students in Detroit are, you know, their parents have made a decision for them and put them in schools of choice, charter schools. And so we're keeping that pathway open so that you can't think of a place where choice is more important. I support it across the state, but there's no place that is more important than the city of Detroit.
You seem stunned Democrats were against this. Why?
Well, I'm stunned, but I'm not shocked. I mean, it's issue after issue after issue that they just vote no. I mean, whether it was, you know, the issue of road funding, even back when we were trying to expel our own members, it's a failed strategy time and time again. And, you know, the pathway to any relevancy is to be a good faith negotiator at the table, and we haven't seen that.
Can you explain how charter schools, poor performing charter schools, could go away under this plan?
Yes, both traditional, and we heard some rhetoric about this on the floor tonight, which is not true, but both the traditional public schools as well as charter schools will be closed if three of the last 5 years they've been in the bottom 5%. So that is not a new clock that starts today. That's not a five-year clock that starts today, but rather one that is retroactive back in time. So those that are in the bottom 5%, three of the last 5 years, will be closed. We did put a condition in there, exception to that, to the extent that that would create an undue hardship, say if we had multiple schools in a particular neighborhood that would close and there was not another option nearby, then there would be an exception to that. But this plan will close schools, and it will not discriminate on those schools, whether they are a DPS traditional school or a charter school.
Is that the school reform officer who's going to make that call then?
Yes, so that is the bill's written by the school reform officer, and it does not leave much to the way of discretion to do that. I think, you know, one thing that was so interesting to me as we were working through on this package throughout the last several months is that if you look at the bottom 25, that top to bottom list, the bottom 25 schools, there are some charter schools there, but nearly every one of them is a DPS chartered charter school.
Last night, some Democrats said it today, they think this plan could fail. It'd be throwing money after bad money, good money after bad money, if the DEC isn't part of it. Do you think this plan is set up to succeed?
Absolutely. Why would we blow $667 million if we didn't think so? It is set up to succeed. However, it's going to take effort. It's going to take effort. And I believe that this gives them a reasonable chance, but people have to continue to work to raise the outcome that we see. Money doesn't buy the results. Money does not buy the educational results. It's going to take effort.
How do you respond to Mayor Duggan's criticism?
His criticism. I saw some things after we passed our first pass plan that I thought were really unfortunate, talking about how this is just throwing money down a hole. I mean, it just shows that so many things that we've seen, whether it was those comments, it shows that it's all about the money, but it also some of the other things that we saw about the DEC, I mean, that was clearly shown that it was going to be just about closing down charters. It would have choked charters out of the city. It's unfortunate, but I'm not going to get into a war of words by any means. I think he's a fine man. We've had good conversations whenever we've talked. We haven't talked recently, but, you know, this is personal. It's a difference of opinion, and I think reasonable and intelligent minds can differ.
Ultimately, though, will the plan work without the Detroit buy-in?
Well, I think in that question, it assumes that they would refuse to work toward positive results and somehow make it fail. My hope is that with the protections that have been put in place, with the money that's been put in, that I know this can work. But my hope is that adults won't get in the way of it.
Now, obviously, this was an all-Republican plan that ended up that was passed out of the House. We're going to presume that's going to be the case in the Senate because, Abby, you talked with David Kinesic up on the island, and it doesn't sound like he's going to give any love to this DPS thing. Let's go ahead and give that a listen.
I think it's really disappointing to see so many steps being taken backward after 15 months of bipartisan work that was done in the Senate.
All right. Well, the good news coming from all this is that it looks like we're going to have only one more week of session, John. That was kind of our understanding down here, and I think that's kind of what the tea leaves are reading right now. Maybe we'll have a normal session or a normal summer for a change, but it looks like this is going to be it. Here we're going to wrap up DPS. We're going to wrap up the budget. Maybe the Senate will do energy. We hear maybe medical marijuana could pass out of the Senate. Could be a busy week in the Senate.
Could be a busy week, but if they leave this week and they don't come back, it will be what I've called the normal MERS summer before, a more normal legislative summer. We don't have transportation hanging over our head like we did a couple years ago. We don't have Corsair Gamrot hanging over our head like we did last year. So it'd be nice to see them go away for 6 or 7 weeks.
Now, when you were up at the island, not to say we don't like the lawmakers.
No, but you know, everybody has a different opinion on this thing about lawmakers running away from taking vacation, being off. It's actually a healthy thing for lawmakers to go back and be with their constituents and meet with their constituents and work with their constituents for a while. And yeah, it's all right if they leave us here for a while without session.
Yeah, we need some time away, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all part of a healthy relationship.
Yeah, things that aren't grow fonder.
That's right. Absolutely. Now, you had just mentioned roads, but you just had an interview with Kirk Steitel up on the island.
Yeah, we got a chance to sit down on the front porch of the Grand Hotel, and I asked him a little bit about what he sees, when he thinks this issue is going to come up again. It's always an issue that seems to come around every decade or so, and I was surprised that he thinks it's going to come up sooner than I thought it was going to come up.
In light of the passage of the recent package, where are we at, and are we ever going to get back to where you would like us to be?
Where are we at? Nobody has started paying gas tax, or increased gas tax yet.
Right.
Doesn't start till 17. One of the things that I was just talking to Lindsay, it occurred to me that point will be 20 years from when it was first, from the 97 $0.04 to now. So that certainty, coupled with federal government did a long-term like a 5-year bill, finally, and then we've had short-term extensions, so we have some stability of what's going to happen for 5 years. Is it enough? It's enough for now. We're going to have to come back to them. Even everybody at the governor said it, the other leaders that were on the stage when they signed the bill was that this is a good start. So there's some people saying, oh, well, we've solved the problem. Even the people that were on the stage said, look, this is a good start.
Okay. So now, when you say we're going to have to come back to this, are you thinking after 18, after 20?
Yeah, I think realistically in the early 20s, we got to come back with something.
Okay.
20, 21, 22, there's going to have to be some other adjustment.
Okay. And you'll still be director then, right?
Now, John, you had some other interviews up on the island. You got a couple minutes with Rick Snyder, the governor, and there was a little nugget in there that we thought was kind of interesting, and Jacob flagged it for us. It had to do with the quadrant. What kind of struck you with that?
Oh, yeah, but John asked him, what are your thoughts on quadrant meetings, and he basically more or less said, we can do without them for the most part. I thought that was kind of, he mentioned it, like there was one time he thought it was valuable on minimum wage of all things, I guess. And so I thought that was interesting coming from the governor, talking about the necessity of meeting with both the majority and minority leaders of the legislature.
Well, and I wonder if he's just feeling that way because he's been jaded by the quadrant up to now. I mean, what has the quadrant done together where there has been an end product that has resulted in real policy?
Well, I mean,
it wasn't the roads, it wasn't DPS.
I mean, and you got a super majority, Republican majority in the Senate, you've got a strong majority in the House. I hate to sound jaded, but he doesn't really need to have them.
Why is that, Jack? I mean, it seemed like, and maybe is it because of the single parties basically in charge that the quadrant really hadn't produced anything?
Well, that's been the situation. I mean, it's basically they've been able to work completely without the Democrats in both the Senate and the House, and you have a situation where you don't have the typical what we've seen over the decades, where there are things in the House where you may be willing to pass things with a majority of the minority party supplying the votes and just having a few people from Republican leadership vote with them. That just simply doesn't happen anymore. It just flat out does not happen anymore. So you're operating under circumstances where there's just not a lot of incentive to be inviting the Democrats in and discussing things. What are they going to talk about? You can't supply, you can offer us all the votes you want, but we're not going to do it that way.
Because we're going to do it our way, and if you want to go ahead and vote no.
Yeah, and that is really a very different dynamic, if you stop and think about it, than it's been for decades.
All right, and one of the other things that was going on in the island, this is the issue that I think environmentalists are concerned is going to continue to be an issue for a while until people get sick of it, and that is Line 5, the straits under Mackinac. And Simon, I would argue that this is a winning issue for environmentalists because there is absolutely nothing Enbridge can do about it.
Yeah, certainly. It definitely employs the idea of the precautionary principle as it relates to environmental policy. It's the question of how much risk are you willing to accept in pursuing the most efficient outcome. There's definitely hauling this oil by train, by bus, by truck, whatever. Regardless, it is going to be most secure in a pipeline. But the fact that this pipeline is placed in such a precarious position is going to, no matter what, perturb environmentalists because of the crucial location that it's at.
Because you can always use your imagination and think, what if? What if we had just and it doesn't matter what kind of precautions you have in place, that you have an emergency response team ready to go. If this thing leaks any oil, everyone's imagination typically goes to, oh my God, our Great Lakes are now spoiled forever. They think of the Kalamazoo River and the disaster that happened there. But in reality, you're right. I mean, every kind of alternative you can think of about how else you could get that oil from the upper to the lower peninsula is more dangerous than what they have right now. So the only thing that you can think of then is, well, what would you do? So what is the alternative? Is it just shutting the pipeline off and then seeing fuel prices go through the roof here in Michigan and certain parts of Michigan that rely on that light crude? I mean, is that the answer?
Maybe we should move back to coal to heat our homes.
Maybe you can get some kerosene, some whale blubber, like back in the 1800s.
Everyone on Mackinac would be used to that.
Oh, yeah. No, but really, I mean, think about what happens the first time you're trucking this stuff across the Mackinac Bridge and there's a windstorm and this truck hits somebody and tips over and spills its entire content into the middle of the straits. I mean, there's no good solution to do it. It's got to get done, though.
We saw this at a national level with Keystone. I mean, there is no patch of land, water, sea, air, that people aren't going to have an emotional tie to in some way. Anywhere a pipeline goes through, people are going to be able to assign their sentimental value to it. It's a strong pro-environmentalist argument, but I think we've beaten the point to death that there's no good way to move the substance. There's no 100% foolproof way to move it, but this is scientifically the best option, just like, the EPA determined with Keystone.
Yeah, and I should point out on the administrative side, the state has been working on this issue for years now, and I think they're going through a risk alternatives assessment that could probably scientifically bring all those things we just said and conclude that yes, there really is no other option, and except maybe replacing the pipeline, since there are concerns about the age of it. The age of it is what really freaks people out, besides its proximity to the strait. So I think the state could have a chance to build that case and convince people, yes, there really are no other alternatives transportation-wise, except maybe having the pipeline through there, but maybe having a newer pipeline, who knows?
And then you think about some of the pipelines that we rely on for our water or sewer or other oil, or other utilities, and how old are they? I guess pipelines and age of pipelines is a concern all around. Did you have another point, Sam?
I think it's also important to recognize that for environmentalists and the perspective that they're coming from, oil, fossil fuels, anything that burns dirty is an energy source that is on the way out from their perspective. And so it is a question of how soon they want that door to close.
right? And then we go transition to wind, and then the next, maybe the next issue down the line is the vroom, 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 vroom. But we'll leave that for another time.
It's a great windmill noise.
Isn't it? I heard the windmill noise in Canada, eh? I happened to wake up in the morning and I heard the vroom, vroom, vroom. And I don't have to put up with it every day like
they do. You know, I make a point on this, though. When they talk about these pipelines and so on, I'm sure these companies that operate them and are responsible for them would be in a lot better shape if they could look back at a record that didn't have, like, the situations with Kalamazoo, and there have been some other ones. So what goes around comes around, because when you look at some of these pipelines over the years that seemingly out of neglect weren't taken care of, it kind of creates a situation where they've sort of given their political enemies something to hit them with.
And I think that's a great point. And if nothing else, this debate about Line 5 has, I think, created a situation where Enbridge has had to put a lot more attention up on that line than maybe they would otherwise.
Looking at it is a good thing. I think the studies that are being done are a good thing. I think the discussions being done is a good thing. I mean, it is a 60-year-old pipeline. It's time to take a look at it.
And it's good to have the precautions in place just in case, and hopefully they won't be needed. All right, well, I had one more thing I wanted to talk about on the podcast, but we're out of time, and hopefully we're going to keep our fingers crossed that this is the last week of session, and so we'll talk about, is the media responsible for Donald Trump next week? Because that could be a very long discussion anyway, and if the legislature is indeed out of town, we'll have plenty to talk about on that subject. So, till next week, thanks, guys, and until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.